listen to that. It started already. Hurry up, would you? That's a mighty tune. This Sunday sees the second episode of our joint ICR Headlands new media production of Rambling House. With me are two of our Rambling reporters, JP Bradley and Tony McLaughlin. Well, boys, how did things go?
Well, Paddy, we were out in Orris, or to be perfectly accurate, Orris Manor, in a cottage known as Dan's Cottage, where big nights are no strangers, and there's a hoolie there every week over the summer months, and we were looking forward to a grand night's crack, and we certainly weren't disappointed.
The whole atmosphere in this cottage is such as you feel comfortable the minute you open the half door and step in. As a matter of fact, the song The Homes of Donegal comes straight to mind, with the big open fire well filled with blazing turf, the settle bed, and all the old artefacts that remind you of thatched cottages of bygone days, as well as a kettle boiling on the crook. No need to waste time having to switch on the kettle and wait.
As you know, Paddy, each of our programmes has a specific theme, and the theme for Dan's Cottage, with it being in Orris, was a most appropriate choice, the Putchin Republic, where Orris people mounted guns at the top of Mamore and kept the forces of the Crown or Law and Order at bay for a number of years. A few years ago, it had been called Free Orris.
Beer, wine and mead would have been the staple drink of the Irish over 400 years ago, and it was only the coming of the potato that gave another ingredient for poaching. Prior to that, corn would have been the main ingredient.
The basic utensils were, one, wooden barrels to hold the wash, that was the corn, potatoes, yeast and water. A well-concealed location, the bases of high cliffs, mountain caves or valleys, essentially near running water. Plenty of turf for a good fire. A metal container well sealed at its top after being filled with the wash. A worum or length of copper piping twisted into large circles similar to a huge corkscrew. And a clean receptacle to receive the condensed liquid after being distilled in the worum, which is cooled by the nearby water.
The test for quality was not as technical as today, but required just as much experience. A sample of the first distilled liquid would be thrown on the fire, and depending on the ensuing flame, the quality was assessed.
Now, the distilled liquid should and mostly did get a second run or distillation. Some even got a third. Naturally, as each distillation took place, the rawness and strength of the potchin was decreased and became more palatable in the process.
Not a drop was sold till it's 7 days old, was a well-known distiller's reply to the Jameson whisky advert of not a drop was sold till it's 10 years old.
Now, as a drink, poaching usually came in three qualities. The first run, which was the original distillation and was given to the general public more for medicinal purposes or as punch, as it watered down better along with ginger or some other flavouring at the time. The second run was the one generally sold for normal consumption. This was the original distillation redistilled. And then there was the priest bottle, which is poaching redistilled for a third time and was more smoother and palatable for what was believed to be a more sophisticated palate.
Poaching was also in great demand as a curative for animals. Example, if a horse or a cow were to break into a field of fresh, uncut grass, the resulting contents of their stomach began to ferment and caused the animal great pain. Now, there were three ways of dealing with this problem. Hit the animal a sudden, hard, unexpected blow, causing it to leap forward, and hopefully it would consequently let a good gas explosion emit from its rear end. Second, stick a sharp pointed object into the swollen stomach of the animal, thus releasing the trapped gas. And thirdly, pour a good portion of poaching into the animal. Thereupon, the fermenting gas would be expelled horizontally from both ends of the animal.
Poaching was also used for bartering. Locally, people from the Isle of Doe would have taken poaching by boat across the bar mouth of Trebega Bay to barter for turf on the Mallon side of the bay. And there were superstitions attached to, because no self-respecting distiller would leave the location without leaving a drop of poaching for the fairies.
Now, there was a lot of misuses of poaching as well. And unfortunately, there was many a housewife split with a hobnail boot by a husband driven mad by an overdose of poaching. Children cowered in terror when fights brought on by poaching were taking place. Children were given a glass of poaching going to school to help to assuage cold or hunger through a lack of heating, clothes or food. On a lighter note, if you're a greyhound owner, a rub of poaching on the greyhound's testicles just as the race began gave him that urge to run a little bit faster.
First terms, my mother just started in the college. She come from a small farm down in Fannerton. She started in the college, and always put the first couple of days the teacher start asking, you know, all the rest of the pupils, well, what does your father do? And what does your father do? And they're all doctors and solicitors and teachers and all, you know. And come around to her, she sort of felt she was out of her depth, you know. Her father was just a small farmer. So she come back home, and always she says she wasn't going back near the college no more. So her father says, why? He was the kind of man, he'd never be stuck, you know. He says, why are you not going back? She says, I'm out of my depth there, they're all doctors and all the rest. I'm out of my depth. He says, you go back and tell him that your father has his own distillery, you're as big a shot as them.
All over Ireland, there were accidents and mob fights associated with the misuse of poaching. In real terms, there was also no government or law to control this misuse. In Ireland in general, it took a crusading priest, Father Matthew, a Tipperary-born priest who became a Capuchin based in Cork, to begin a nationwide total abstinence programme that helped turn the people away from all sorts of alcohol.
Locally, there was a tragedy where a number of men involved in poaching distillation fell down a cliff face and were killed. This was probably a catalyst that caused the Bishop of Derry to declare having anything to do with poaching a reserved sin. Example, an ordinary priest couldn't give you absolution and confession, only a bishop could.
Now this led in turn to a typical Irish story that well known Irish could come up with. Two well known North and Shone men had imbibed some poaching, and as the local priest couldn't give them absolution, off they both headed to the Bishop's Palace in Derry. They were probably both petrified, as in those days a bishop only appeared to the general public at certain high masses, funerals of the aristocracy and confirmations, where he'd be accompanied by every priest in the diocese, plus an army honour guard. He certainly wouldn't meet his lordship, Wonder Shopping in the Strand Road.
Anyhow, after a debate, one of the men elected to enter the bishop's inner sanctum, whereupon he confessed the terrible deed of imbibing poaching. The bishop, after some consideration, gives the man a penance that he wouldn't speak to another human being until he arrived back at his home place. As now the shriven man left the room, he met his companion on his way in. The companion asked him how he got on, only to receive a blank stare and no reply. The companion then gave a remark that has gone down in the history of the Derry Diocese. That statement was, well, if he made an effing a dummy of you, he'll not make one of me. And off they both headed home, with only one shriven of his alleged son.
The methods of hiding poaching were many and varied as well. Among the favourites were to bury the containers of poaching in the middle of a boundary wall or a stream, therefore making it difficult to define the true ownership of the product. Of course, back in the days when poaching was in its heyday, crimes had occupied the lengths of big yards, and later on the Yard of Shehana, where lack of dog licences, lack of a bicycle light, benweeds grown in your field, and of course the manufacture of illicit alcohol.
When a still and its contents were found and seized, it was taken to the local barracks to be disposed of, usually by dumping down a gully trap and onto the water table in the presence of a superintendent or inspector of the police. God knows what that did to the quality of the water near a barracks.
Well, however, I have it on good authority from an old yard or two that after the inspector or superintendent supervised the dumping of the illicit spirits, a barrel located at a convenient spot along the pipeline would be retrieved later on full to the brim of the previous dumped spirits. I have also been assured that there was always a gully trap in many barracks that was kept cleaner than any hospital operating room for the very purpose of retrieving this water of life. Now, this could very well be a total pack of lies. To quote some well-known person, you might very well say that, I couldn't possibly comment.
Before Christmas 1939, the internees got agitated and got their own cookhouse and some of the old hands began to utilise the boiler house to make potching out of the old potatoes. Pat Scullion was the chief distiller, but one of his accomplices, Paddy Morrison, a devout Catholic, had a fit of conscience and confessed to the prison chaplain. To his horror, he was told that potching making was a reserve sum and that he would have to go before the bishop, a somewhat difficult task. He had to sit out the wire before his conscience could be eased, to the general hilarity of the more irreverent internees.
That poor crater was an internee in Derry Jail during the war, and they set up a wee Gaelta in Derry Jail.
And a jail tuck.
A jail tuck, yeah, fair play to you. And the warders even were speaking as Gaelica, and it was a bit like, I suppose, what eventually became in the H-blocks in Longcaish. The boys were in the kitchen cooking, and of course they started to distill. Only the conscience got the better of that poor crater. His problem was he was an internee in Derry Jail on Bishop Street, appropriately named, but the bishop was over at St Eugene's and they wouldn't let him out to get his absolution, and the priest in the jail couldn't give it him.
Bishop O'Donnell of Raphoe strongly promoted the temperance movement, eventually making the selling of potching a reserved sum, forcing the illicit distillers to move across the Swilly to Inch and to Derry Diocese, and forcing the Bishop of Derry to ban it.
Talking about potching, we turn about its illicit distilling of whisky, but whisky nevertheless, and some good whisky. The making of whisky was an integral part of farming in times gone by. It was thought nothing unusual. Every farmer who had grain would run off a batch of potching for his own use and further for sale. The illegal aspect of it, it actually came about with James I of England. You can take the date from 1603, the date that you see in the Bushmills distillery, when he started to issue licences to make whisky. It was, I suppose, very attractive offer for those who wished to pay a licence and make their product legal. Every town land nearly had its whisky, or even attempted at least to go down the legal route. One that springs to mind is that big square tower in Burt that was Latham's distillery. Now that was up and running and functioning for about 30 years. Close by in the village of Newton Cunningham in the 1830 maps shows right smack in the middle of the main street another distillery. So there were those, there were licensed premises throughout the country. However, with the pressure came, I suppose, from these guys who were paying the license for the establishment to take action against those who weren't. And this is where you get the bogeyman, the distilling of whisky is disappearing into the hills. You know, they never lost their knack or art, and they thought, indeed, it was their right to make this whisky. Needless to say, with the romantic aspect of it as well, people were going for the illegal whisky. There was very little difference in the quality at that stage, because it was up to everyone to make very good whisky for sale. During the period since then, at different times the establishment have tried, you know, to enforce and put the illicit distiller out of business. In too many cases, they actually won out. When you think of, again, one of the most successful in its own distilleries, Latham's of Burt, were actually forced out of business. And one of their market employees, in fact, was to use the label Inch Own Whisky in an effort to combat the illegal. You know, as far as the illegal men were saying, this was real Inch Own Whisky. But as I say, Latham's, they were very successful for the while they were in it. There's an account of boats coming in at the Farland Bank, boatloads of coal to keep this distillery open and running, but still they couldn't win out. And by and large, if you go through, you know, all those distilleries all right down through the country, most of them were put out of business by illegal distillation.
And it was a man down, we'll see, in Malinhead at the time, told me about putting a lock clock and hams off the clock.
Yeah.
Was there any boys when you were the wildlife ranger by any chance that would have had soaked a lock of barley in the potching just to...
Well, there were a few stories, but probably one that comes to mind there. You talked about Isla Dole too. Do you remember Willie the Shore?
He had served a few stances and Sligo, you know. But he'll tell me, I said, the one time he said, the guard arrived, make a big seizure, that got good information apparently. But he said, I didn't give a damn, he says, because the tide was on full, he says, I knew they weren't going to get any punch in that tide. It was all prayed out of the water.
So that would have been the same as this idea of burying it in the middle of a riverbed or a marsh ditch.
That's,
that was it.
On usual ground.
A guard, now retired, still living, told me that they got instructions when they're out searching for poaching. And one of the things they were to look out for was when they're walking across bogland, if they heard the ground squelching, it was a sign that the ground had been recently dug up and that maybe water had seeped in and the topsoil was loose. And there's a good chance that they heard the ground squelching underneath them that they should look in there to find the poaching.
Well, there are a few funny stories going on. One I heard was in Desert Tegney, a relation of mine was making poaching and he had hundreds of treacle cans all around the house. Hundreds and hundreds of them. And the revenue got very suspicious and they surrounded the house. But of course, he knew when to hide the worm and the still and everything, so he got it out of the way. So they questioned him about it and he said, well, no, I'm not making poaching. He says, well, how do you explain these hundreds of empty tins of treacle? He says, I don't like jam.
The Mountain Dew, this is from Jacob Harry Swan's book, may sound romantic, but it's manufacturer's hard realism. It is a job for the experienced and skillful hands. Barley is selected and steeped according to the month of the year and the condition of the weather. The spirits, after distillation, should be allowed to mature from 5 to 15 years. I don't know if that happened to the spirits. This is a rule, however, that is more honoured in the breach than in the observance, and too often the product is used in a fresh state. There are people who will tell you that poaching, if good, tastes even better when duty paid whisky. Its appearance is a clear liquid, not unlike water. The clearer it is, the better it is. A man asking for it will very likely refer to it as the wee stuff, or the clear stuff, or a drop of the crater.
Grass is growing, waters flow in a free and easy way, but give me enough of the good old stuff that's made near Galway Bay. And policemen all from Donegal, Sligo and Leitrim too, they can take a tip and take a sip of the real old Mountain Dew. Now learned men who use a pen have wrote your praises high. That sweet punching from Ireland green is made from wheat and rye. Throw away your pills, it'll cure all ills of pagan or Christian or Jew. Take off your coat to reach your throat with a real love of let grasses grow and waters flow in a free and easy way, but give me enough for the good old stuff that's been near Pollen Bay. And policemen all from Donegal, Sligo and Leitrim too, we'll give them a tip and we'll take a sip of the real old mountain dew.
Illicit distillation was so widespread and then shown that every stratum of society except the clergy was involved. In the early part of the 19th century, Major Bellingham Swan, the Inspector General of Excise and Licences of Ireland, reported that there were an estimated 3,000 private distillers in all Ireland. Of these, 43% or 1,300 were based in Inishowen. Another report stated that the people of this barony were smugglers and distillers from their cradles and added that they had a bad and inveterate nature. While the practice was widespread, there were areas in the peninsula of particular notoriety. An East Coffey Inspector General of Excise reported circa 1810 that the townland of Monydara in the parish of Kildaff was completely overrun by distillation. Other places mentioned were Urris in the parish of Clamanny and Iskeheen in the parish of Templemore. The establishment tried various methods to curtail it at best they could. And one of the measures that they introduced was the townland, the parish fine. It must be remembered as well, like, during those years of the early 1800s, landlords who held the land and had their tenant farmers, they weren't particularly caring where the money for the rent was coming from. So they turned a blind eye. They were getting their rent money. However, then it was deemed maybe a good idea to fine the landlord if a still was found on his estates, which in turn then that thought better, no, let's fine the total population. Well, we would have had secret societies formed, you know, to deal with this type of stuff as well. Use the, I suppose, watchmen and hide men, and they were taking it away, all sorts. And to give you an idea of the Cadaff sizes, again from the same book of Brian Bonner, to realise the extent of the financial burden imposed on the people by the fining system, we consider as a sample the amount of fines in the parish of Cadaff as set out below. In the spring assizes, this is only in Cadaff, in 1814, there was 47 fines. Total amount, £1,175. Again, the summer of 1814, the amount in total fines is £1,425. The following year, spring and summer, somewhat similar. But over those four sittings of assizes, the total amount of fines collected from the tenants of the Cadaff parish, £6,200. I mean, that's a colossal amount of money. And that's certainly affecting every person, regardless if they're involved in distillation or not.
I thought we would just read a little bit about what Charles McGinch had to say about potching making. There was no better drink than malt whiskey if the fens, I think that's the dregs, isn't it, was kept out of it. Lots of houses had malt houses in times ago. The old house belonging to the Grants and Clough Finn was the first stone house in these parts and was built around 1810. Under the room floor is a cellar for malt, and you get into it by lifting a flat stone in the floor between the beds. Then he goes on to talk about Glashidi. He said, well, with the fines and all, people took to making potsheen away in the hills. Glashidi Island was another great hide, even down to my own day. One time, the men came in from the island with a run of potsheen, and the revenue men came on them and seized the whole lot. But some men about Mullagh, who spent a while in the Navy, heard about the seizure and came down through Mullaria and attacked the police and took every drop from them. The men were well armed with sticks and the revenue men were afraid of them. And he goes on to say, all the old potsheen makers threw the first glass away. They said it was for the fairies, and if they kept them on their land, they would warn them in some way if the revenue men were coming. The revenue men were for nothing else but for putting down potsheen. Later, there was a big barrack of revenue men in Gaddy Duff. There were 35 men and a sergeant at one time. The inside walls of the old barrack were built of turf. After a seizure of potsheen, an officer came down from Buncrana to see that all the whiskey was spilled down the grating. But the men had a tub under the grating, and before the officer was out of sight, they were all enjoying themselves and had in some of the neighbours and had a great time.
A war broke out between the Protestant rector and the inspectors of excise. The Protestant rector was the Reverend Chichester, who was connected here with Clonmelly, and he wrote a book, a little pamphlet criticising the inspectors of excise because of the way they were treating the people. They were coming along, and when they couldn't pay, they would lift the cattle and bring them into a pound in Carrandullen. So he was very concerned with this, the poverty that the excise officers were causing because of their actions. And in return then, the excise officers replied. The man concerned was a man called Aeneas Coffey, and he wrote a pamphlet attacking Chichester's defence of the potsheen makers. But Chichester wasn't encouraging potsheen, but he was attacking the excise men because of the way they were going about their business and the poverty they were causing. And then Coffey was later on attacked in Lyngad, and he fled to Scotland, where he opened up a still himself. It's called the Coffey Still.
how they were able to defend Burris was that there was the HMS Saldanha underground on the far side of the Swilly, the west side of the Swilly there, and there was a funny, it was a captain picking him, and he was an ancestor of Lord Longford, and there was 274 people lost on that ship when she sank, the 4th of December 1811. And what happened then, that coincided with the Poitiers Republic, because apparently the Irishmen was across, and got some of the guns and the cannons from her. Showed you how low the intelligence it was. The British out. Oh, sorry, we shouldn't say that. But anyway, the only way they knew anti-Irish was over the gap, over Mamore.
Yeah.
And the men apparently were with a few cannons off this ship, and they set them up in Mamore. Of course, they were the high ground, everything else, easy to defend it, you know. So apparently, it took them 3 years, I think, to subdue the Republic. But even that, they're still at that stage. There was a general, actually, Del Zeal, I think is what his name was. And he had a command with the whole thing. But he came in May 1815. And he, with that, he had a whole, he must have had an entire range of it, I don't know what he had with him. But anyway, he subdued the Republic anyway. But in October, apparently, the Red Union came back with about 200 men, bit them out of it again. So I don't know whether it finished that easily or not. I would say it wouldn't. It would take them a while to subdue them.
Actually, Charles McGinn's got another description here of... He says, another time the Redcoats were prior to the revenue men, another time the Redcoats made a raid for Poitiers and Morrison's in Strade. There was a big party going on when the alarm got up, and the men went outside and left the women inside to hide the whiskey. The soldier had ordered the women to open the door, but they refused, and the soldiers put their bayonets through the door. But as the blades came through, the women broke them off with an iron bar that they had. At the heel of the hunt, the officer in charge, he was the name of Dalzell, that's what you were saying, climbed up onto the roof and started going down the chimney. The men outside called to the women in Irish, "Cai cochan na leabhar sa tine," throw the bed straw on the fire. So the women put two or three armfuls of fire and smoked Dalzell out of the chimney and burned the clothes off his back.
I reached down Banyan House one time over the head of Poitiers making. The army was captured for 3 or 4 days in the descent of Derry to get released them. It was over the head of Poitiers.
Some of the place names that were definitely associated with Poitiers making, Lodnasac and Altala is Altahala, isn't it? I think that was where they hid the sacks of malt. And then there was another place called, I think it was Altenpecht. We used to think was it comes some kind of a serpent, but it's actually the worm in the equipment. And that's where that was hidden.
As a warning to illicit stillers in the Eskaheen area, should they make an appearance, word was got to the Presbyterian Church and the bell was rang. They would ring a bell and warn from the Presbyterian Church to say that the revenue men were on their way. Mm-hmm. You know, so your brain...
Well, they were all involved in the production, wasn't they?
But they were not so much in that they're dependent on the results of a good harvest of pottery. This is where your cash flow was coming from, yeah.